Okay, great.
I'd like to get started. Thanks to everyone for joining us this evening, and thanks for joining us throughout the series. This is the last of our Mary Hytken Dumont Jewish University here at Anshe, and we're very, very excited about this launching of this new commentary on Avot, on the Ethics of the Fathers, or essential chapters, in the style of a Gemara. So that's just a stylistic thing, that the text that we're reading tries to be written in the style of a Gemara, of a Talmud, asking different types of questions, and today we'll experience some other Talmudic methods of having a discussion. But each week we have a different topic. So our topic this week is so crucial as the value of every individual. I would like to discuss some sort of more practical aspects of it, and how do you show that you value every individual. That'll be our first part of our discussion. And then we'll get to what are the underpinnings of what makes every person so special that we want to treat them that way. So those are the two aspects and the two elements of our discussion. You need another sheet? Oh, no, that's not the right sheet. Yeah. That's an essay about the whole project, which you're welcome to look at. Okay, so we begin with a Mishnah. In the Talmud, you always begin the discussion with a Mishnah, Mishnah being the shorter Hebrew part that was written earlier, and then the Gemara being the part that's written later. So the Mishnah we begin with, Steve, would you lead us off?
Okay. Ben Isaiah used to say, "Do not be disdainful of any person, and don't distance yourself from anything. For there is no person who hasn't his moment, and there is no thing which does not have its place."
Okay, right. So whether it's a person or a thing, you can't treat it with disdain. You can't, baz has to do with bizayon, which sometimes means you can disgrace it, you can't treat it lightly. And even things have their own place. Everything has its own place. We're not going to mention, but one could have mentioned the story of King David with the spider. You know that story? That he said, "Oh God, what do you need spiders for?" And then one time he was hiding from King Saul, and there was a spider web that protected him from danger, so that he realized what the purpose of everything was. But today we're not here to discuss so much the things, but the value of every individual. Okay, let's begin. Sally, would you do our Gemara-like commentary?
"Let us say that Ben Azai is not like Ben Zoma, and not like Rabbi Eliezer, and not like Rabbi Eliezer Ben Shmuel."
Tom will often do this. They'll often pile up a whole bunch of opinions that seem to differ from the passage we're dealing with right here. What is so different than all those other rabbis? And these are rabbis we dealt with in our second session when we talked about the prime directive in Judaism. Let's go ahead.
"He is not like Ben Zoma, for we learned in the Mishnah above, Ben Zoma says, etc., who is honored? One who honors humanity, as it is said, for I will honor those who honor me. And those who treat me lightly, I will be treated lightly."
I'm sorry, I should say lightly.
Okay. "And those who treat me lightly, I will be treated lightly, or I will treat lightly."
I will treat lightly. Right. Okay. Will be treated lightly. Okay, go ahead.
"He is not like Rabbi Eliezer, for we learned in the Mishnah above, Rabbi Eliezer says, may the honor of your friend be as beloved to you as your own. He is not like Rabbi Eliezer Ben Shmua, because we learned in a Mishnah later on, Rabbi Eliezer says, let the honor of your student be as beloved to you as your own, and the honor of your friend like the honor of your teacher, and the honor of your teacher like the fear of heaven. They all hold that one must honor all others, and Ben Azai holds that it is enough not to disgrace others."
So, if we want to talk about what is our relationship to other people, how do we appreciate others? So all this Mishnah seems to say is, don't treat anyone lightly. But we learned two weeks ago that many other rabbis said, no, every person should be treated with great respect. Even perhaps you should treat everyone as if they're your teacher or something. So what kind of low bar is he setting here that all you have to do is make sure don't treat anyone disdainfully?
I see there's a big difference, though, because in the bottom, they refer to certain types of people, your teacher, your friend, and so on and so forth. In the top, Ben Azai says, any person. And so if he's going to say any person, you may want to set the bar slightly different.
Good. That would be a good answer. We could say that no, it is not a dispute. Ben Azai is speaking about any person, and they were speaking particularly of friends and teachers. Perhaps when they say friends in Jewish parlance, what does friends often mean?
Other Jews.
Yes, other Jews. And when he says any person, perhaps he means Gentiles. So this would be a possible solution. Let's see what the Fall Gemara has to say as to this proposal. We have a proposal on the table. We have one answer that Ben proposed. The proposal is that Ben Azai, this Mishnah that we read on the top, has a lower bar than most Mishnayos because it merely demands that you not be disdainful of others. So let's, and he disagrees with all the others who say you should honor other individuals. Ruth, would you continue for us?
That one is obligated to honor.
First we say no. In other words, it's not true. Right. In other words, it's not true.
Okay.
It's not true that there's a dispute. No.
No, that one is obligated to honor others. All do not argue.
Yeah, the one is obligated to honor others. All do not argue. Right.
So here we are dwelling with the wicked.
Right. We're talking, Ben, some of you suggested that maybe we're talking about everyone in the world, including Gentiles. Here we're going even a step further, that we're talking even with the wicked people. There's whatever you want to fill in the blank, Nazis, terrorists, enemies, people who you have no respect for, you know, whatever you think is the lowest of the low, fill that in here, and that's what it's talking about. Don't be disdainful of any individual, even those who are wicked, by whatever definition you would want to have. Go ahead.
For the Rabbi Israel Lifshitz, author of
Tiferet Yisrael,
said, Ben Azai speaks even of a
ignoramus
and the wicked of Israel. May the merciful one save us.
Right. Now, hopefully, we don't know anybody who's wicked. Yes, in a society in which there were these great rabbis, Rabbi Akiva was around, and they were available to teach everyone, and some people didn't avail themselves of that. So that was a great travesty. Today, people are mostly ignorant of Judaism because of sociological and historical reasons. But in those days, an ignoramus was someone who chose to not avail themselves of all the learning in the community. But in any event, so even those people, even let's say the wicked of Israel, as I said, whatever you think is wicked, fill that in. Even those should not be treated disdainfully. And now a little story. Go ahead.
But why? Did we learn in Pesachim? Pesachim. Whoever sees in his friend a lewd matter, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak said, it is a...
Now, this is a very disturbing thing. He says it's a mitzvah to hate him. Now, what does that mean? Firstly, hate, generally, what's an enemy? An enemy is someone who doesn't talk to you. So if you saw someone that you thought that they were behaving in a way that wasn't proper, if you would not talk to them for a while, maybe they'd return to a better way. But anyway, the question is it really true that you don't want to treat anyone disdainfully? I mean, aren't there some people that you might want to put in the category of disdainful treatment? Because, let's say, they... I don't know, the criminal background, or they harmed you in a terrible way, or they insulted you, or they are evil individuals of some sort. Isn't there somebody that you would want to treat disdainfully? Wouldn't someone fall in this category where perhaps it was a mitzvah to hate them? Because if someone, if you say, people who stab, go running around stabbing people in Israel, they're not so bad. They just, they're disgruntled about things. So, they go around, they stab people. 70-year-old, they stab 70-year-old people that turn out to be Arabs. They stab children. That's just the way. That would be disdainful. If we don't treat people like that disdainfully, then what are our values? So, isn't there a place for treating some who are wicked, whatever that might, however you want to define that, isn't there a place for that? And after all, it says in Proverbs, the fear of Hashem is the hatred of evil. And it says, do I not hate those who hate you, Hashem? Right? Rather, if you turn to the third line toward the end, rather said Rabbi Yehuda, Aryeh Leib, alter the Sfat Emet. Go ahead.
Rather said Rabbi Yehuda,
Fourth line.
Oh.
It is.
Fourth line?
Yes, it is. In the middle.
It is, as we say in Yoma, all that which the Holy One, blessed be He, made in this world, He made in it for His honor. As it says, everyone that is called by My name and whom I created for My glory, I have formed him. I have even made him. And one who disgraces him is dishonoring the honor of heaven.
Okay. So the answer is that even though you might think there's room to certainly disassociate yourself from some people for their evil ways, he says, no, every person is made for the glory of God. Every person adds the glory of God. This is the answer that Rabbi Lifshitz gives. Let's see. Michael, you want to continue? Rabbi Lifshitz said,
it is not for nothing that the Holy One, blessed be He, left this person living.
Right. If the person is living, then there must be a reason why they're here, and they have a value, and you cannot be disdainful of them. Go ahead.
It must be a hidden purpose, for it says in Samuel, first book 2, verse 3, Hashem is the God of knowledge. And it says in Proverbs 16, verse 4, all that Hashem has made is for His sake, and even the wicked are for a bad day.
See, on a bad day, you need a wicked person. You need someone to take care of certain bad business that none of us would want to do. He comes in handy for that occasion. Okay, go ahead.
Don Isaac Abarbanel, 15th, 16th century Lisbon, Venice, said, these rabbis surely argue against Ben Azza.
So here's a different opinion. We were trying to say that really we said at the beginning that everyone agrees. Everyone agrees that you should honor other people. But if someone is wicked, then you should at least not treat them disdainfully. So really everyone agrees. You should know, though, that the Abarbanel, famous commentator from 500 years ago, says that there is an argument. Go ahead.
Ben Zoma said, one should honor everyone, even if they are not of stature. And Ben Azai said, one should not honor those of lower spiritual stature, but one should not disgrace.
Right. So, you know, it could be that there is a bit of a dispute here. All right. Okay. Now, I'm sorry, now for an interesting story. An interesting story about how this is more of a utilitarian story. In other words, if we say every person is of value, we could say that on a fundamental level, that everyone, you shouldn't be treating anyone lightly, because as we said, God has a purpose for them. That would be in a more fundamental level. Maybe we'll talk about other reasons later. But then there's a more practical level to never treat anyone lightly. And we have a story in the Talmud. It's a colorful story. It's worth repeating. Let's take that. Michael, you want to share that with your neighbor there, with Larissa? Go ahead.
What does it mean? Do not treat anyone lightly. Rabbi Obadiah of Bartenura said, don't say, what can this person harm me? As we say,
somebody might say, that person, I'll treat him disdainfully. Why? He's not powerful. What can he do to harm me? Go ahead.
As we say in the Jerusalem Talmud, in Terumot, at the end of the 8th chapter.
As we know, there are two Gemara. There's only one Mishnah, but there are two expansions of the Mishnah called Gemara. One was in Babylonia. One was in Palestine. Some people refer to it as Jerusalem Talmud. Actually, Jews were not allowed to live in Jerusalem after the Romans took over. But we call it Jerusalem Talmud. Go ahead.
Gilchot was a pig farmer. Was hit by children of the house of study of Rabbi Judah the Prince.
Right, so this is not a pretty story about Jews. When the kids were coming out of yeshiva, they used to pick on this fellow because he was a pig farmer. Obviously, they didn't like pig farmers, so they acted like children sometimes. Though maybe they threw rocks at him, whatever it was. Not a nice thing. Go ahead.
He became king and went to the city of Parmias.
Probably it might be near the Banyas. It might be near northern Galilee, a little bit of while away from Tiberias. Go ahead.
And sent letters to the rabbis to be with him after Shabbat immediately.
But he knew he was neighbors of them. He knows they can't come right after Shabbat. Go ahead.
He told his messengers, do not give the letters only in the evening of Friday as the sun is setting. so as to give them no time to prepare.
He wants them to disrespect the king by not showing up on the when they're summoned. Go ahead.
And the messenger came to them in the evening with the sunset, and Rabbi Judah the prince and Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman were going down to the baths of Tiberias.
You know Tiberias is famous for the hot baths and all that. Go ahead.
Antigras came, and Rabbi Judah the prince wanted to yell at him.
Now, Antigras, I would like to read it that he's one of these people that you might want to have disdain for. He's maybe a member of the Jewish community who became a Roman or something, and that's why they wanted to yell at him and throw him out or something. But later we're going to see that he seems to have some mystical powers, so some want to suggest that he's a ghost or a shade or a demon or something like that. Anyway, there are a lot of... welcome to the Talmud. There are stories like that. What you make of it, nobody knows. It's interesting to think about it. But let's continue. So think about those two possibilities. He's either a sort of an apostate Jew or he's a demon of some sort. Go ahead.
Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman said to him, "Leave him. He is coming to do miracles." He said to him, "What are the rabbis doing?"
It's sort of like, you know, how are the rabbis doing? What's going on? He started the conversation.
They told him the story. He said to them, "Bathe, for your Creator will do miracles for you." After Shabbat, he carried them and brought them to Palmias.
Yeah, so this seems to be the mystical part. How could they get there so fast? The king knew that they can't get there so fast. How did he bring them so fast? Was he a camel or something? So it perhaps suggests that there was some mystical thing that went on. Go ahead.
They said to him, "The rabbis are outside."
The rabbis have arrived. They're here. Go ahead.
He said, "They cannot see my face unless they bathe." There was a bathhouse and he heated it 7 days.
Page 3.
And 7 nights. He and Tigris went out and cooled it before them, and they got up and came before him.
So he thought he would scald them and burn them and they're in the hot cauldron. But Antigras, again, did some sort of miracle, or maybe he was an insider, maybe he was some kind of Roman, and he was able to cool it off. Go ahead.
He, the king, said to them, "Just because your Creator may do miracles, you make light of the king."
It was, all right, so you can do miracles. I'm not impressed. You've been disgracing the king. I'm really mad at you. I have no respect for you. Go ahead.
They said to him, "Dikluk, the pig farmer, we treated lightly. Dikluk, Taneas, the king, we do not treat lightly."
What are they saying? What are they saying?
Now that he's king, they're going
to... As soon as he became king, they always treat him as... They never disrespected him. Right? The other guy was not the king. They have utmost respect for the king. The person he was when he was a child, nothing to do with this. So it's a very good... It's a very typical sort of a Talmudic kind of a distinction. But whether the king would buy it, but it's clever. Sometimes when you have a repartee with the king or something, you hope that they have a sense of humor. You know, so... Anyway, go ahead.
"Even still," he said to them, "do not denigrate, not a young Roman and not a young scholar."
You know what's going to happen to a young scholar. He'll become a great scholar, but a big scholar. Same thing with the Romans. You never know what's going to happen to a Roman.
Where did it say that the rabbis denigrated him? It just said kids.
The kids were in the house of the rabbis. So they were associated. It's your yeshiva, yeah. Right, maybe the rabbi didn't find out about it, or he knew about it, he didn't do anything about it. That's correct. So this is a good example. We're bringing this passage from another Talmudic source to bring in connection with this mission. Don't treat anyone lightly, because you never know what's going to happen. But we also said shouldn't treat them lightly, because what? Because all the God made was
for his glory.
So if someone is in this world, it brings glory to God, so leave him alone. So these are a more utilitarian answer, a more fundamental. We'll get to more fundamental answers later. And here's another one, another more fundamental answer. Larissa?
Rashba, Rabbi Shimon ben Samach Duran said, "What is the reason not to denigrate anyone? Because it says in Proverbs, one who makes fun of the poor has disgraced his maker."
His maker meaning?
Yeah. Yeah. "And it is as if he has disgraced the son of a king. Or because it says in Pesachim, it is like the story of Rav Yosef, the son of Rabbi Joshua ben Levi, got weak and passed away, sort of. When he came back, his father..."
Now he came back to life. Go ahead.
"When he came back, his father said to him, 'What did you see?'
And he said, what did you see in the other world?
I saw an upside down world. The ones above were below, and the ones that below were above. He said to him, my son, you've seen a clear world.
Well, you didn't see a topsy-turvy world. You didn't see everything upside down. You actually saw things very clearly. That was the most clear vision you ever had. Go ahead. So that's what the story is in Pesachim. Now the Fog Gemara comments and says,
and perhaps the disgraced one is here among the ones on high in the world to
come. Right. So you think this fellow is not worth the time of day, but that's in this world. We know that in the next world, a lot of the downtrodden ones here are great above. Shlomo Carbach was very good at this. He would find, you know, some guy sweeping the floor. He said he's the holy floor sweeper. He'd find the chazan who had no voice. And he'd find out that, you know, the Nazis took away his voice or something. And, you know, he's really the holiest chazan. And he found, you know, he always find, you know, a greatness where others saw denigration and lowliness. Okay, so this is cute. It's nice, but we want to move on to our more fundamental part of our discussion a little bit later on. Another cute interpretation of there's no person who doesn't have a time. So that's kind of a funny expression. There's no person who doesn't have a time, like he's going to have his day in court, he's going to, you know, his 15 seconds of fame. So what does that mean? So a clever interpretation. Ben, want to take that for us?
What does it mean that there's no man who does not have his time?
So we put throw in the Hebrew, sha'ah. Go ahead.
Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz said, it is from the language of Scripture. And to Cain, and to his offering, he did not turn.
Also sha'ah. So sha'ah usually means ma sha'ah. If you want to ask them what time is it, you say ma ha-sha'ah. What's the time? But sha'ah is an obscure word. It appears in Genesis and not too many other places. And the Nusach Sfarad, we say it in Ritzeh. Tzfilatam she'eh. God turned to the prayers of the Jews. Turn. So he didn't turn to Cain's prayers. In other words, what does the Mishnah mean? Go ahead.
I don't make light of anyone lest this person have some prayer to which the Holy One, blessed be He, will turn.
Right. So again, in lecha adam she'ein lo sha'ah, there's no man who doesn't have a turning to. There's no man who doesn't have a time when God will turn to his prayer. Now, do you think he's nobody? But everyone has one prayer. You know, everyone has that time when they get their perfect prayer. God says, whoa, you know, this guy may be a so-and-so and a so-and-so and a so-and-so. But that prayer, in that particular circumstance, I'm going to hear that prayer because he's really in a jam or whatever it is. So there's no person who doesn't have that moment. So you should respect people, not just for, you know, maybe a scholar might say, well, one time they had a good idea, good thought about the Torah. Or a philosopher might say, one time they thought a deep thought. Or right? So this is a more spiritual, more kind of an idea, that a person is of value because they have their moment with God. Their moment where God says, I'm with you. I'm right on that prayer. So it's an interesting way of looking at the value of every individual based on the acceptance of their prayer on a one-shot deal. Let's see, Ben, you got a short one. We'll let you continue a little bit.
You
should know about the Ruach Chaim Veloshim. There's a great chain which I consider myself actually a small part of as well. The Ruach Chaim Veloshim was the teacher of the Salvagic family, and there was the Beis Halevi, and then there was Reb Chaim, and then there was Reb Moshe, and there was Salvagic, and then you know, Rabbi Lichtenstein, and Rabbi Lichtenstein's children, and then I'm a student of those people. So it's a chain going back to this book was written in 1859. Go ahead.
What is the term treat lightly? It is like what it says in Isaiah. In Israel to the looters, from the meaning of robbery.
Right, so we just had a novel interpretation of the word sha'ah, time, that it means where God turns to your prayer. Now we're turning to the other expression, and we're going to give a novel interpretation, that don't treat anyone lightly. He says, no, it doesn't mean lightly, it means don't steal from anyone. Go ahead.
And this is what it means. Do not steal from the poor by not returning greetings of peace to them.
Right, somebody, there's a poor guy, he says, he sees Rothschild walking by, he says, hello, Mr. Rothschild, you know, and they go, ah, you know, and he just sort of walks by. He says, no, no, you have to return it, you're stealing it from him. Go ahead.
As it says in Brachot, and Rabbi Helbo said in the name of Rav Huna, anyone who knows that his friend usually...
Page 4.
Shalom, you should preempt him and say shalom, as it says, seek peace and pursue it. And if he gave him peace and he didn't return it, he is called a robber, as it says, when you ate up the vineyard, when you robbed the poor is in your house.
Right, you have stuff in your house that's from the poor. Okay.
It is like Shammai and Rabbi Ishmael.
So before we said that the Mishnah was against three rabbis, now we're saying it's like two other rabbis. So we're going to quote other Mishnayos that support the, if indeed this Mishnah is talking about the importance of returning hello and goodbye to people. There are other, two other Mishnayos that talk about that. Go ahead.
It is like Shammai. As we have learned above, Shammai says, make Torah permanent, say little and do much, and receive everyone with a good countenance.
So you should always greet people with a good countenance, with a smile. Go ahead.
It is like Rabbi Ishmael, for we learned in the Mishnah earlier, Rabbi Ishmael says, be gentle to the head and light on the young.
In other words, if there's someone who's the head of things, someone who's important, should be gentle with them, you know, take it easy, don't get into any fights with them, and if the young, don't yell at them, be light with them. Go ahead.
And receive everyone with joy.
Okay, you should greet everyone with joy. Go ahead. So you have two rabbis, one in chapter 1, chapter 3. It sounds like the same thing. I thought everyone had an original idea. You know, this rabbi said this, this rabbi said that. Here you have two rabbis saying the same thing. We've dealt with this before. Go ahead.
The Rambam said, Rabbi Ishmael is adding to the words of Shammai. It is not enough to receive him with his countenance, but his heart is not with him. Rather, it should be in joy.
Right, some people might say hello, and they have a good countenance, they put on a good face, but there's no real joy. He says, no, when you see someone, you have to actually have joy. Which relates to the deeper question, which we're going to get into now, which is why should you have joy when you see someone else? Go ahead.
And Mary said, they do not argue. Rashbat says, Shammai speaks of having guests so that they will not be embarrassed. And Rabbi Ishmael speaks of any person in the marketplace.
Right. In other words, there are two things. One, you have to greet people. Remember at the beginning of the chapter, in our first sessions, we were talking about hospitality. So maybe somehow this mission is also talking about hospitality. When you have a guest in your house, it's particularly important to make them feel at home. Why?
So they feel comfortable.
Right? They're not going to take enough chicken. They won't take enough vegetables, right? Because they don't feel comfortable. So you want to. So that's something else. And this is talking about just when you see people on the street. So that's another possible distinction between one Mishnah and the other. Okay, so that was sort of an aside. Once we got into the question of hellos, of proper greetings, that one way to show your respect for others is to greet them respectfully. Maybe that's what this Mishnah means, that you shouldn't treat people lightly. It means you shouldn't steal their hello. Then we got into these other two Mishnahs that dealt with saying hello, or not only with a nice smile, but also meaning it and feeling it. Now we're going to get to the fundamental reason for which we treat people so importantly, so graciously, and As Rabbi Lichtenstein, Alav Shalom, said, this idea of Tzelem Elohim, the idea of image of God, is the topic of the rest of our discussion. And it's from a Mishnah here. And we mentioned before that that Ben Azai, I believe it was the same Ben Azai, said that this was the most important principle in the Torah, that in the image of God we were created. That's the most important basis for human interaction. And Rabbi Akiva is going to assert the importance of this value as well. And the question is, what does it mean to have the image of God? The image of God. We throw that expression around. Oh, we respect everybody because they have the image of God. What does that mean? God doesn't have an image. So we're going to have to get into that in a deep kind of way. But first we have to read the Mishnah in chapter 3, Mishnah 14. Now, by the way, we're going a little bit out of order. The first Mishnah we dealt with was in chapter 4. This Mishnah is in chapter 3. We're going backwards in some sense. Let's continue. Carrie, why don't you come into the circle here? Let's see. Okay, go ahead.
Rabbi Akiva would also say, beloved is man, for he was created in the image of God. It is a sign of even greater love that it has been made known to him that he was created in the image. As it says, for in the image of God, he made man.
Sometimes you want to give a present to someone, but you don't really want to have a relationship with them. So like, you see a kid and you don't want to get closer with the father. You don't really have much to do with him. So you give the kid a candy, and you're happy about it. The fact that the kid doesn't know who you are makes you happy, because you don't want to have a relationship. But if you want to have a relationship, then you should, put, the Talmud says, smear some, you should, whenever, the Talmud says, when you give a present, you should always smear a little chocolate or something on their mouth. The mother will ask, where'd you get the chocolate? tell him there was a man who was tall, and you know, and he'll figure out who it was, and that'll create relationship. So when God wanted to embrace us, he not only gave us the image of God, which we haven't defined, but also he told us about it. That he told, it says in the Bible that he made us in the image of God, which creates this ongoing connection that we know we got this gift. But what it is, we haven't said yet. Go ahead.
Beloved are Israel, for they are called children of God. It is a sign of even greater love that it has been made known to them that they are called children of God. As it is stated, you are children of the Lord your God. Beloved are Israel, for they were given a precious article. It is a sign of even greater love that it has been made known to them that they were given a precious article.
Which, is, of course, is what? The Torah.
As it is stated, I have given you a good purchase, my Torah, do not forsake it.
We always say that when we put away the Torah, ki lekach tov natati lachem, Torah ti al tazu. Okay, good. Now the essential question, page 5, what is Tzelem Elohim? What is the image of God? What does it mean? So I created a new thought discussion that doesn't appear in any particular place based on different commentators who talk about this question. Some of them, in this case, some of them are commentators on Pirkei Avot, which you have all these books here, different commentaries on the ethics of the fathers. And some of the sources here are drawn from elsewhere where people discuss Genesis or other places where people discuss philosophy books. What is the image of God? Mr. Kramer, would you like to continue?
What is the image of God? Rashi, 11th century France, said, in the image of himself of man, not in the image of any other animal.
And so Rashi tends to be kind of concrete. He's saying we're in our own image. It's a unique image. It's not anybody else's. It's not God's. It's not. He made God in his image, meaning whose image?
Man.
His own. Right. So that takes away the anthropomorphism problem. And then it also saying that you're unique, right? You're not like animals, right? The evolutionary people. Someone said this week they wanted to make chimpanzees part of the human species or something. So no. We say we don't see any resemblance, right? We don't see any resemblance to anybody else. And continue.
Rav Sadia Gaon, 9th century Egypt, Baghdad said, sovereign.
Now, when I give these two, when I mentioned different countries, so many rabbis had to migrate for various anti-Semitic reasons. So he, for instance, was in Egypt. He was also in Baghdad. Okay, go ahead.
This is accurate.
Oh, it's a sovereign. So what does it mean? What does it mean, sovereign? What do you mean? That the image of God is, it means sovereign. Sovereign. The image of God means that he's sovereign. Go ahead.
This is accurate in the verses.
In other words, it works out well in the verses.
In the verses. Since it says in Genesis, let us make man in our image, in our form, and let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, etc.
Right, so it talks about having dominion. So we see that the image of God is that he has dominion. It proves it. And that, again, that's me writing. That's typical Talmudic style. You say, someone says something, and then you say, and it even works in the words too. Isn't that convenient, right? It even works in the words. It works the words of Genesis. Go ahead.
Actually, we don't have dominion over, say, lions or tigers or wild
animals. No, we do. That when we have a zoo, or when you shoot a lion, or, you know, oh, God forbid, it's going to be all over YouTube now. Or then you have shown your dominion over the lions. Yes, absolutely. Or you make a reserve for them. You say you can only be over here, you can't be there. Yes.
The Rabban said he is similar to those above in countenance and splendor.
Above, meaning in heaven, yeah. Similar to the angels, God, that in what? In countenance. No, it's not in looks, but in sort of something beyond looks. The countenance, I mean, we talked before about greeting people with a good countenance. Doesn't mean with good looks. It means with an aura of, you know, sorry?
Presentation.
Okay. And splendor. Oops, splendor, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
As it says in the Hillel, and he made him a bit less than the angels, and he adorned him with honor and splendor.
Rabbi Soloveitchik often quotes this verse, a very important verse, chapter 8 of Tehillim, that God made human being a little less than angels. It's a very audacious statement, unbelievable statement, humanistic statement. And he adorned him with honor and splendor. So, there's something that God possesses called honor and splendor. He gives it to us. Go ahead. So the image of God means that a person has a certain splendor. Like my mother says, everyone has a certain beauty in them, right? Everyone has a certain beauty. Hold on one second. You're reading so well, it's too fast. Since his soul is similar to those above. So now we're saying that his soul is similar to those above. What's the image of God means that his soul is similar to God. We're going to talk more about that later. What does that mean? Is your soul from God? Is it what exactly is he saying about souls? We'll learn more about that later. But let's put that aside. Go ahead. Ibn Ezra said. Just go back a little bit. Ibn Ezra said. Okay, one second. So Ibn Ezra said the upper soul of man does not die. So there's an idea of the eternal soul. Now, if you ever think about that, it's a little strange. Do you ever think of yourself as an eternal being?
No.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, it depends. Eternal, does that go backwards also? Well, that would make you like God, right? Because God, there's a Jewish principle, almost every single philosopher agrees with, that God was the very first. So if your soul is eternal, there's only one way you could be eternal also. What would that be? Sorry?
Be God.
Yeah, you'd have to be God, right. So are you a part of God? So we'll get to that later. But so maybe that's the image of God, is that your soul doesn't die. Right? The animal, you figure, the animal may have like a little bit of a soul, but then it dies. But our soul goes on. Let's continue. And then one second, and then he's there. One second. And then the Ibn Ezra also said that you're sovereign over your body. God is sovereign over the whole world. We're sovereign over our bodies. Right? Now they say there are also all these microorganisms living in there, so there's like tons of creatures in there. Right? So we're sovereign over that. We know a person is a small world, so you're sovereign over that. So it's another twist on the sovereign part. Rashi's grandson, go ahead.
Image is really our wisdom.
So here's a classic idea. Some people associate this with Reb Sadiagon. I couldn't find it. But not sovereignty, but wisdom. Not splendor, not sovereignty, wisdom. You know what our image of God is? Wisdom. Go ahead.
Elohim,
means, I'm sorry.
Means angels, as it says, and you will be like angels. God said about man after eating the fruit.
Right. So remember it said, oh, we better watch out. Better not let them eat the other fruit, otherwise they'll be like angels. Notice a human being has the potential to be like angels. Image of God means image of
angels.
Image of angels. Yeah, I don't know how that fits into the wisdom idea, but he's trying to take it away from being, the image of God. Go ahead.
Or from that which it says in Psalms 82:6, I said you are angels and you are all children of the Most High.
We read that in the Psalm of Thursday. Okay, so there are several sources that indicate that we are like angels. Or we're potentially like angels. We can also be like animals, but we're potentially like angels. Okay.
So said Ibn Ezra.
Right. Period.
The former said, image is eternal and intellectual.
So he also mentioned the eternal thing that the Ibn Ezra mentioned. He mentioned intellectual that the Rashbam mentioned. Go ahead.
The Ratam Sofer said, for man is made alone.
So Ratam Sofer was in the 19th century. He said, man is made alone. Aha. So what's the image of God is that we're alone. What does that mean? We expand on it a little bit. Go ahead.
As we learned in the Mishnah,
you skipped something. As the Maharsha, 16th century Poland said,
for the image of man is created singularly, which is the image of above, like the singular one of this world.
So how are we like God? We're singular.
What does that mean?
God is the only one like God, and I'm the only one like me.
Yeah.
So that nothing more. It could be that I'm a rotten individual, but there's no one else like me. So that makes me like, that's the image of God, is that you are a singular individual. There we assume all the ants are all, they're all basically ants. There may be some minute difference, but as far as we're concerned, all ants are ants. But as far as human being, we can assume that axiologically, existentially, every individual is completely, completely different than someone else.
But I mean, two dogs that are your pets are different from each other.
Right. We would say they're not the fundamentally existential. They're basically in the Platonic sense. No, in the Platonic sense, they're both dogs. That's
we're
it.
We're both people.
No, but we have to believe that the uniqueness of an individual is unfathomable. Meaning, yeah, dog might be a little more. It's not so complex. He's a little more emotional. He's a little more huggy, or he's more violent, or he's more. There are 20 adjectives you can use, and you're done with the eulogy. But when it comes to a human being, or Salvation put it like this: it's not in your sheet. This is something else. He says, you know what? The individual is reflected in the privateness of the person. What does that mean? He says you can be married to someone for 50 years and you still don't know them. Why? Because that's how deep a person is. It's unknowable. You can know your dog. That's why it's not so singular. There's another dog like that is similar. But a human being is only knowable, maybe even not to yourself. It's so, so deep and so individualized. That's the image of God. Yes.
How about identical twins?
Right. So existentially, they're completely different. Right. The fact that they have the same nose or something, that's not so important. Right. Fundamentally, their souls are completely different. Right. No relationship.
Well, you said nobody's like me, but an identical twin.
Right. Because we're not talking about looks. We're talking about the hidden, that which you can't see. It was unknowable.
So identical twins didn't descend from the same soul?
Right, right.
They're totally.
No. Matter of fact, right. You see Yaakov and Esau, right, right, right.
They're at the same time in the same womb.
Right, right.
As we learned in the Mishnah, it's omitted, therefore was the first man, Adam, created alone to teach us that whoever destroys a single life, the Bible considered as if it destroyed an entire world.
So a person, right, so we were created alone to show that the whole world was worthy of one person. The Tzelem Elohim is the singularity of the individual, the notion that one individual is worth everything. God were to create the whole world just for you. That's why, go ahead.
Yeah, but Hashem said you shouldn't. It's not good to be alone, he said to Adam.
Right, but that begs the question. So then, why did he make us alone? And the answer is he wanted to show. One answer is, though, several answers here, that he wanted to show that the whole world was worth it just for that person. And that if God forbid someone kills someone, they just killed the whole world. Wow. Right.
Have you ever saved a single life, the Bible considered it as if you saved an entire world.
Right, so we should know that this is from Sanhedrin, that statement which we always say, it's from a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Go ahead.
Furthermore, only one man, Adam, was created for the sake of peace among men, so that no one should say to his fellow, my father was greater than yours.
Right, so this is a counterpoint. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg is very good on developing all the points and counterpoints in this Mishnah, and he says that in Judaism we have two values, and they're equally important. One is uniqueness of the individual, which we just went over with Steve here, and then the other idea is equality. We do agree with the Western value of equality, but we also underscore the value of uniqueness. And that's why you'll find there's a Kohen, there's a king, there are Jews, there are non-Jews. There are distinctions. We have unique roles, but we're all equal also. Right? A Jew can't say he's different fundamentally than a Gentile. We all come from Adam. But on the other hand, a Jew is unique. Don't tell me I'm the same as you. That's dehumanizing if you tell me I'm exactly the same as you. Because part of my humanity is being unique. So there's an interesting tension between the two. And the image of God is, yeah, I don't know if we can, in other words, I brought this passage to say that we are singular, and that's the image of God. One might suggest the part of the image of God is being the same as others too. I don't know. I have to think about that. Let's go on.
Also, man was created singly to show the greatness of the Holy One, blessed be He. For if a man strikes
singular
coins from one mold, they all resemble but one another. But the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He, made each man in the image of Adam, and that was one of them resemblance.
Right, so this seems to say that don't worry about twins, apparently they're different. Go ahead.
Therefore, every sacred person is obligated to say, the world was created for my sake.
We now know why no one's exactly the same, because you're rolling so many dice because you've got the DNA is the size, is the information in DNA is the amount of information in a large book. So therefore, you're rolling so many dice that it's the combination is worth, you know, more than a telephone number. You know.
But,
yes?
It makes it sound if the world was created for my sake, I don't care about the other people.
Right. That's why you have to go back and forth between the equality and uniqueness. If you didn't have the two points, you would kill everyone else and just live by yourself.
Yeah.
So therefore, we said you're also equal to everyone else because your father's not. So great, I'm worth the whole world, but so is he because we come from the same father. You can't say that I'm different than he is. We both come from Adam. So, all right. So the uniqueness of God, uniqueness of man. There's a midrash that says that on Shabbat, when the bride goes to greet the groom, you know, what's the idea of the bride? The Shabbat doesn't have a match. You see, Sunday's match with Monday, Tuesday's match with Wednesday, Thursday's match with Friday, and Shabbat has no match. So the Jewish people also have no match, right? Not in Europe, not in America. Nobody seems to really be a 100% ally. Very close in America, but sometimes not 1,000%. So Israel's kind of alone. So that's why we have God to go with us. We have Shabbat to go with us, and also what that midrash said about God, about the Jews, it's also true of every individual, that I'm alone and God is alone. And as Rabbi Soloveitchik often says, I reach out to God in my loneliness, because I begin to understand myself, and God reaches out to me in His loneliness. So there's that commonality, and that's the image of God. We share that singularity.
Okay.
Let's see. We'll give Mr. Kramer a break. Marty, would you read for us on Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, a great Kabbalist?
Moshe Cordovero, author of Talmud Gador, said...
So if you want a little Kabbalah, there we go, right here.
Man is worthy to be like his maker in his deeds, and then he will be like the upper image or the main image above us.
Right. Right. You want to have the image of God? Act like God. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you can't create the whole world, but you can be very creative. And there's another aspect. You can be like God in these positive attributes. Now, you don't want to be like God in the negative attributes. You don't want to try to take revenge like God takes revenge. The Torah says, don't take revenge. God can take revenge because he does it without getting upset. You know, he just does it the way it's supposed to be. But in positive attributes, we try to be like God. We talked about this in our first session. Go ahead.
It is like Rabbi Hama, the Rabbi Hanina, and Soto, for Rabbi Hama, son of Rabbi Hanina, said.
By the way, if you're wondering why I always repeat myself, that's the Talmudic way. You say, it's like Rabbi Yochanan, for Rabbi Yochanan said. That's the style. Go ahead.
What means the text, you shall walk after the Lord your God? Is it then possible for a human being to walk after the Shekinah, or has it not been said, for the Lord your God is a devouring fire? But the meaning is to walk after the attributes of the Holy One, blessed be He. As he clothes the naked, for it is written, and the Lord God made for Adam and for his wife a coat of skin and clothed them. So do you also clothe the naked?
Right. So if God does kind things, as we see in the Torah that he does, we too should do kind things to others, burying the dead like God buried Moses. So we need to act like God. So how can we be in the image of God? It's something you do. When you act kindly, we have the capacity for kindness. This also made this different from a dog. You might say that it's, you know, we can act altruistically, etc. But let's continue with the next paragraph. Since I stopped you in the middle, why don't you continue the next paragraph, Marty?
According to Rav Saya Gaon and Rashbam and Reddit, Abby David Kimichi, the image of God of man is his intellect.
So we're now laying out, we've talked about different opinions of what the image of God is. Now we're laying out a broad debate. So according to these bunch of rabbis over here, the image of God is intellect. Go ahead.
according to the Ibn Ezra and Rambam, the image of God is in the splendor of man.
Second possibility, splendor. Go ahead.
As Ibn Ezra said, it is Ezekiel, and on the throne, the image of the likeness of a man on it above. In what sense is this?
Go ahead.
Man and his creator are similar in their splendor and glory.
Right. There's this really weird verse that says that he had this image of the angels and more angels and more angels, and at the top was a throne, and on top was like the image of a man. A man? You mean God? A man sits at the top of the throne? You know, is there Christianity here? What's going on here? So he says, no. Just like a man can potentially have splendor, the image of God that the prophet saw, Ezekiel, was an image of splendor. The human being is endowed with some splendor. So, okay. Now, whether that's everyone has splendor or potentially have splendor, we'll talk about that later. Now, here's another possibility in the later commentary as to what image of God is, and Rabbi Lam, often known as Norman Lam, called Nachum Lam, Rabbi Lam lays out some of these opinions for a debate for us. Let's see. Diana, would you continue, please?
Rabbi Nachum Lam said...
Ramchal,
Rabbi Moshe Chaim...
Luzzatto,
18th century Italy, author of...
Misilat Yesharim.
Said the image of God is the free will of the man.
Did you ever hear that? That the image of God is free will. That's what it means. Interesting. I didn't find it in the earlier commentaries. I don't know whether he's the first to say it. But in any event, the free will. Now, that's similar to dominion, right? Because dominion means I get to do what I want to do when I want to do it. So, but anyway, go ahead.
Since we spoke of the image of God, which is about free will, we taught also about free will.
Right. In other words, remember, we had our last session was about free will. That was from the next Mishnah. The previous Mishnah says that Rabbi Akiva also said that beloved is man, that he's made in the image of God, and more beloved because he's told about it. So one Mishnah is about free will. I'm sorry, one Mishnah is about the image of God, which is free will, and the next Mishnah is about the free will paradox with predetermination. So it flows well. If you don't think about it this way, you say one Mishnah is about the image of God, which is about splendor and souls. Next Mishnah is about free will. It's got nothing to do with each other, just different things Rabbi Akiva said. Oh, maybe not. Maybe they're connected. Continue.
And it is like Rabbi
Aryeh Levine,
Israel 20th century, who said, what does it mean to...
I think he was Rabbi Greenblatt's rabbi in Jerusalem, but go ahead.
What does it mean to say in
Kohelet
3:19, and man is not more than an animal at all?
Right. It's one of these verses where, you know, Ecclesiastes says, because all is vanity. There's no difference between man and animal, because all is worth nothing. But he uses the expression, ayin, nothing. Ayin also means ain, which means nain, which means no. Go ahead.
To teach you that the difference between man and beast is in the power to say no, meaning to decide to go against one's nature and inclination.
Now this is what you call creative drush. This is not a simple interpretation of the word. This is just a cute kind of thing. So throw it in as a little doodad that the difference between man and beast, the image of God of a man, is his ability to say no to decide our fate rather than being drawn by just our passions to go this way or that way. Now, a little excursion to another verse. It doesn't say image of God, but it talks about the soul. And since some people suggest the image of God is the soul, so we need to go back to the verse that says that God blew into his nostrils a soul. So, Francine, would you read that for us?
And he breathed into his nostrils a spirit, neshama, of life. What is the spirit of life? Rabbi David Holzer and Rabbi Joseph...
Rabbi Soloveitchik said, this is Talmudic style, that you say, one rabbi said, the other rabbi said, the other rabbi... Go ahead.
The Rambam
says...
Shemona Prachim, chapter 1, says, the neshama is the creation of the creator.
Right? In other words, God makes a soul. It's not... God doesn't give you of his own breath. He makes something called neshama. This is for the mystics. This is anathema. This is a heresy. But that's what the Rambam says. He wasn't a mystic. Go ahead.
Rambam says.
Ramban. That's Nachmanides says.
Says the soul is a spirit from the mouth of the one on high. Reda.
So in other words, it is from God's mouth. In other words, it's from Him. Did He create it for you?
No.
No, it's not a created being. It's part of Him, the original being. That's why you're eternal. Two very different views. It's a big debate. Go ahead.
Redok was like the Rambam, for the Redok said the creation of man in His image is the creation of the soul.
Right. Redok said that when we say that God created man in His image, what did He do? He created His soul. Because He's thinking that a soul is created. So we have a little debate there. And the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi of Provence in the Middle Ages, he follows the Rambam's more rationalistic view that the soul of man is created. It could be created for eternity going forward, but not backward. Right. It's a difference. Right. Now, we're going to get to my most fun part. I hope you enjoy it. We're going to get into what the Talmud often sets up, question. And then they say, well, let's prove, does it go like this or does it go like that? And does the question apply according to this rabbi? No, the question is only, the question doesn't apply according to this rabbi, it doesn't apply according to that rabbi. The question is only according to this rabbi. And then you say, okay, well, let's come in here, let's see what the answer is. This source seems to indicate that this is the answer. No, that doesn't work. It says the Talmud will always reply, no, that's not a good proof. I say, oh, come in here, what about this source? And the Talmud will say, no, that doesn't work either. So, in the unremaining 10 minutes, we'll just do that and we'll call it a day. I do have 2 minutes. So, with that, we will go through this, just 2 paragraphs. All right, just enough, perfect number of paragraphs. Yes,
it was,
Suzanne.
Yes. It was asked, a truly wicked person, does he have an image of God or not?
So I lied a little bit. Nobody really asked it, but we're pretending that someone asked this question. So I think, Mr. Kramer, you asked this question last week, right? Could a truly wicked person have the image of God? So it's an important question. In other words, is it a human endowment which is inviolate? You must have an image of God because that's what it means to be human. Or you say, oh, well, the famous question. Hitler have the image of God, right? That's where it, you know, kind of boils down. So it's kind of a repulsive question. So we have to think about this. Go ahead.
Okay. According to
Ramchal,
the image of God is free will. We do not ask.
According to Ramchal, that image of God is free will. We don't ask this question. Go ahead.
For surely free will is given to all.
Right. Now, we figure that everybody gets free will, but then go ahead.
Or if you wish. You can say that even according to the one who says that the image of God is free will, one can lose free
will.
Lose free will, as was the case of the Pharaoh. And according to the opinion of
Right, so there's an idea that Pharaoh lost his free will. So if that's true, then it can't be a fundamental human right that everyone gets free will. Sometimes you lose it. So maybe that would answer the question. That we see that Pharaoh did lose his free will. So if you say that image of God is free will, and we know that Pharaoh lost his free will, we see that you can lose your image of God.
How did Pharaoh lose his free will?
We will see that.
Because God hardened his heart.
Right. We're gonna see it explicitly. But
because he said, when you go, you do these miracles, right. I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
So that he won't.
He had no choice. His heart had to be hardened because God said so. Right. It goes back to last week. Yes?
It also says in the Haggadah, and Hashem hardened Pharaoh. Yes.
He
hardened his heart.
Right.
There was no free will.
Right. Some say that he had free will up to a point, and then he lost it when he kept disobeying. So God said, okay, is that what you want to do? That was your choice. Your free will. We're just going to help you continue. So another plague and another plague. Let's continue.
Okay, Rav Gaon.
And according to the opinion of Rav Sadia Gaon,
the image of God is sovereignty.
That image of God is sovereignty. If that's what we say, the image of God means that we're sovereign over the world, we take control, we make things, we create things, we mold, we shape, we blow up things, we can create phones and heal people and stuff like that. So we do not ask. Go ahead.
For surely, there are wicked people who prosper.
Right. In other words, there's no question. If sovereignty, does everybody get sovereignty? Do wicked people get sovereignty? All the time, right? That's the problem, right? ISIS, right? And all the other terrorist organizations in the Middle East. They get plenty of... we don't even ask the question. If that's image of God, then everybody gets it. If image of God is sovereignty, everybody's got it, because all the wicked people I know get it, right? And we, what about us, little guys like us? We don't blow anybody up. Right? We have sovereignty over our families, over our lives, what we do. We decide what to do. I get to decide. I want to be a shoemaker. I want to do this. Everyone gets to decide what they do. Go ahead.
According to the opinion that image of God is wisdom, surely not all people are wise.
Now that's not very, very egalitarian. If you say image of God is wisdom, see, the Rambam likes that because he wants to be a philosopher. He wants everyone else to be a philosopher. But everyone's not a philosopher. So then what does it mean? So do we say, minimal wisdom is good enough? Just the wisdom that a human being has, even the wisdom of the simplest person with a meager IQ, he's better than a dog. He can decide things, and he understands some things, and can have a conversation, and maybe that's good enough. Or do we say no? But if it's wisdom, then not everybody's so wise. You can see this going different ways. Yeah.
But everybody has a different type of wisdom.
Ah, good. Good.
And there are things to be learned even from people without a high IQ.
Good. That's the idea that we've been talking about the uniqueness of individuals. So the rabbis say, I forgot who said this, I have to look it up. They say that you always have something to learn from everyone. There's some way in which another person is greater than you. Or we said before, and Ben Zoma said, who is wise learns from everyone, implying that everyone has something to teach. That's very good. So maybe not. Maybe you could say image of God is wisdom, and it's endowed to everybody. Some people could try really hard not to know anything, but it doesn't matter. They had a good idea once. There's something, they have some insight into something that more than I would even, more than you and I would. Continue.
And according to the opinion that image of God is the character of the human being, which should be like his, we do not ask, for not everyone walks in his way.
You see, that idea, it's a very appealing idea. Oh, image of God means to be like God. What is God? God clothes the naked. He buries the dead. He does all this stuff. Oh, that's beautiful. That's the image of God. Well, is that egalitarian? Does everybody have the image of God? Right? Then what about Hitler? Right? He kills the dead. He makes you dead. Right? Right? He's not walking in God's ways. Right? So then it would be an endowment that you could have. Right? Maybe he was very nice to his pet dog, whatever. But it's something he could have had. It's not that God robbed him of it. It's something he potentially had, but not something he exercised.
Well, he had free will not to use it.
Right. So you could say, right, you could say that he has it, right, that he really does have it. He has that image of God. It's the capacity to be like God. It's the capacity to have mercy and things like that. You don't have to exercise it. So that might be another way of looking at that. Go ahead.
According to the opinion that image of God is neshama, or that image of God is the singularity of man, we ask a completely wicked person, does he have the image of God or not?
Right. So if it's neshama, right, so or if it's the singularity, what about that? Does a wicked person have singularity?
Yeah,
it probably does. Maybe I would take that back. But does a wicked person have neshama?
Well, God breathed it into him.
Right, you would think so.
Where did it go?
Right. I don't know. You have to think about it. Yeah. It's debatable, yes. Maybe the question is not according to... Maybe we'd rewrite this and we would say, no, according to the opinion that it's neshama, of course everyone has neshama because they're still alive. And if it's singularity, why not? I mean, it can be singularly wicked. So maybe that would be a better way to write this. I'll have to reconsider. Now we're going to try to bring some proofs. This is a Talmudic way. We staged a question. We professorially said, I'm not asking a question based on this. I'm not asking. You ever hear a professor start off, he's saying, for 20 minutes, what he's not going to talk about tonight, right? So we got that out of the way. Now we're going to bring some proofs from two things. And that will be our conclusion. Steve, our chairman of adult education, will finish us off. Yes.
Come in here.
Yes.
Come in here, for Moshe gave honor to the kingship. For we learned in the Brisa of
Tanhuma
bow, and we will not leave here until all your servants come to me.
So Moshe and Aaron say to Pharaoh, we're not going to leave here. They're not leaving Egypt until you're going to come and bow down to us and beg us to get out of here. But he didn't say you. He said, your servants will come beg. From here?
From here we learned that Moshe gave honor to the kingship, for he did not say, you and all your servants will come bow to me.
He didn't want to say to the king, you're going to come bow to me, even though he will.
If you say that the image of splendor for this reason, they gave him, the splendid king, honor.
Right? If you say the image of God is splendor. So did Pharaoh have splendor?
Yes.
You bet he had splendor, right? More than any of us. But
free will, does Pharaoh have free will?
Ah, does it not say?
And I will pardon Pharaoh's heart.
As Suzanne mentioned before, go ahead.
Rather, Pharaoh is different, but he is a king.
So the Talmud would say, forget, it's not a good example. He gave honor to him because he's supposed to give honor to kings. It's like in Japan, their whole ethical system is based on the idea that you have to honor the emperor. Right? So you honor your parents so that you will honor the emperor. So in this case, we honor this no good murderer, baby killer guy, because he's the king. If you don't honor kings, then you have what you have in Syria and Iraq, and you have anarchy. So we honor kings, but it doesn't mean that he has any image of God. So you can't prove it from there. End of first proof. Second proof.
Come in here, for it was taught in the Brisa of Tosefta of Sanhedrin. Reb Meir used to say, "Why does it say that the defilement?"
I apologize for all the typos. Go ahead.
Of God is hanging.
Right. In other words, there is a Jewish idea of hanging, but the rabbis say as soon as he goes up to hang, you take him off. You certainly don't want to spend the night because the image of God is up there. In other words, a human being is hanging there. You got to take him off as soon as you bring him up. You put him up and then you take him right down because it's terrible to have the image of God hanging.
You mean after you hang him?
You do hang him for 1 second, but then you take him right down.
Oh.
Right.
It is compared to two twin brothers who are similar. One went and became king of the whole world. The other went out to be abandoned. After a while, he was caught and they were crucifying him on the cross.
So sometimes you can date these passages. They're written during the Roman period where that's the type of... Jews never crucified anybody, including Jesus, because it's not one of our four punishments that we give for capital punishment. But Romans do, so the Midrash speaks the language of its time. And today we would say execution, you know, by lethal injection. And in those days you say crucifixion. Go ahead.
And everyone who went by was saying, he seems similar to the king.
The bandit looks like the king.
Yeah.
Right.
This is why it says, for the curse of God is hanging.
Right. So it's a person who looks like God, whatever that means. Go ahead.
So we see that even with the wicked, there is an image of God.
Right. So you could say, this guy's obviously wicked. Why do you think they're hanging him? Right. Now you could also say that, so you could say, no, he did tshuva. Every person before he's executed, they does tshuva. So he did tshuva. He's not wicked anymore. So that's another possibility. Go ahead.
No.
No, it's not a proof.
Okay. Like it is taught in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, how do you hang him?
Well, we don't give all the details, but go ahead.
You take him off right away, and if not, you violate a commandment, as it says, do not let his corpse lie on the tree. For you shall surely bury him that day, for the curse of God is hanging. Why is he hanging? Because he blessed, meaning cursed, the name. And it turns out that the name of heaven is defiled.
So they interpret it to mean that the curse of God is hanging. I mean, the cursor of God is hanging. He who cursed God is hanging. So we do, according to this interpretation, we don't call a hanged individual the image of God. We call him the cursor of God. So maybe that's the answer. Go ahead.
The mayor says, when a person suffers, what does the Shekhinah say? My head hurts, my arm hurts, etc.
Either meaning that he feels like we're a part of God, or he just feels terrible when a human being hurts. Okay, go ahead.
According to the first Tanna, we don't leave him hanging because he cursed the name, not the honor of the blasphemy.
We're not trying to honor him. We're hanging him because he cursed the name.
Like,
I mean, we don't.
The curse.
We're taking him off the hanging. Sorry?
It's like leaving the curse visible.
Right.
Audible.
Mm-hmm.
According to Rev Mayer, even the blasphemer is part of the divine above.
Right.
Dr. Shalom Rosenberg of Bar Ilan said, to every man is the image of God, but you can forfeit it.
Right. We mentioned this last time. That. But we have to figure out, according to whom would he say that? Can you forfeit your free will? We said you could. Could you forfeit your splendor? I don't know. I would think that not everyone has splendor. Maybe not. Maybe everyone still has some splendor. The homeless guy's been sitting there. He's about to freeze to death. Maybe he still has some splendor to him. Hard to say. In any event, Rabbi Soloveitchik has one other interpretation that's interesting, that since we're here to do a mission, we're here to do something, so we're the emissaries of God. We were sent here. We were created. An emissary is like the person who sent him, legally speaking. And if I send you to do this legal act on my behalf, then you are just like me. So God has sent us. So in that sense, we're the image of God. We've been sent by God. It's another idea. But in any event, we laid out different meanings of image of God, and we tried to move according to the different images, the different interpretations of image of God. Would we or would we not be able to apply that to the wicked? And we saw that maybe perhaps in some of the interpretations we could say it doesn't apply to the wicked. But in most of them, we can imagine that it still applied to the wicked. That image of God still applies to the wicked. And that's the basic humanity. So we go back to the first Mishnah. Why should you not treat anyone with disdain? Because everyone has their time, meaning that they have some sort of... The image of God rests with every individual. Like we said, God will turn to that person once, because at least once, because every person has their moment, they have their value, they're here for a reason, and they're emissaries of God. So, this is the an attempt to flesh out in a more expansive way, to have a full dialogue, full discussion about one particular philosophical topic of the image of God. And we flesh it out as if it was a Talmudic discussion, because there is no Talmudic discussion of, you know, what is the image of God. There are rabbis through the centuries who have talked about it. And hopefully through this format, we brought it to life a little more, and we brought all these rabbis in a conversation with each other in a way that was not quite, perhaps was not quite done before. So I hope you enjoyed it, and I want to thank everyone for coming. And I just want to tell you that I appreciate people coming along for this ride, for this discussion, because I've really put many hours into this and other passages like it, and I'm enjoying it. I hope you enjoyed it, and I appreciate your being here to discuss it with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebbe. This was really an interesting discussion. It was excellent, and I want to thank all of you on behalf of the Adult Education Committee for attending this series, and if you don't mind, I have a one-question survey that I'd love for you to fill out. And when you finish, just put it into my yellow bag. So you don't have to put your name on it. I also have a bunch of pens and pencils.
We appreciate honest feedback. It's very important to us. Also giving us some ideas about our next session as well.
But it's one question. It says, there are three choices. Just check one of them. Which of these best expresses your feelings? Number one is the next Anshe University series should also be on Pirkei Avos. That's choice number one. Choice number two, the next Anshe University series should be on a different subject, but a later series should return to Pirkei Avos. And choice number three is, I do not want any more Anshe University series on Pirkei Avos. So if you would fill those out, then the Adult Education Committee would really appreciate your help.
And we appreciate it. We appreciate it.
Here are pens and pencils if someone can give them out. And
yes.
I'll hand out the surveys.
Yes, I want you to know it's important to me as well. I appreciate the feedback. Thank you. Thank you, Steve.